Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
You're in the madhouse now.
Ahoy, ahoy, everybody, and welcome to our, I believe, first Talking Futurama interview.
Yeah, you're right.
I'm one of your hosts, the stronger than Gumbercules, Bob Mackey, who's with me today, as always.
You know, I'll say this on a future podcast, but I'll repeat it. I'm a big robot, and I demand a big podcast interview.
And speaking of which, soon you'll hear us talk to the writer of that Anthology of Interest segment, Eric Rogers. And Eric Rogers was an assistant to the writers for the first two production seasons of Futurama from, like, the very first episode onwards, after the pilot, and he would later go on to write for the Comedy Central episodes. We talked to him for about 30 to 40 minutes about his time with the show's rocky history with Fox, and what it was like to finally race to the rank of writer for Futurama.
Yeah, it was great talking to Eric. Eric's fun on Twitter, too. He'll say it at the end, but follow him on Twitter, at Eric Rogers here. He has been very helpful to just this podcast for, like, questions of, hey, in the early days, what about this joke? What about that joke? Because not only is he a professional television screenwriter in his own right, but he also was a witness to all of the writers coming up with those jokes. So he was there on the ground floor, and he gave us some really great insight into those early years, especially Futurama and the Comedy Central years too. Like, so it was just super awesome to talk to, you know, a professional writer who also was a witness to all of the crazy stuff, the ups and downs of Futurama, like,
and
Eric was.
All that Harvard magic floating around in the air. But yes, as we always do, we'll ask you if you enjoy the interview. Please let Eric know. He is at Eric Rogers here on Twitter, and Eric is spelled E-R-I-C. So at Eric Rogers here, please let him know you enjoy this interview, and who knows, we might talk to him again, or maybe other Futurama writers.
We can cross our fingers, But I guess here, let's go quick into that chat with Eric.
I'm so lonely since I came to the future. Will you be my friend? Ow! Who are you?
I'm a big robot, and I want a big cereal.
You too? Will you be my friend?
Put her there, pal. I meant your wallet.
So we're here with Eric Rogers. And Eric, our first question is, we really want to know, where did your career in television writing begin? And how did it lead to being a part of the Futurama team?
Great question. One I love to answer. So I moved to LA right after graduating from college in 1995. And I knew I wanted to be a writer. Didn't know much about TV writing per se. Thought I, you know, like most kids who have stars in their eyes in the mid 90s for Hollywood, also a kid from the 90s, a kid growing up in the 90s, you know, The Simpsons was everything. So I started working in television, and I started to work my way up the ranks. I started as a PA and then became a writer's assistant and a script coordinator, and, you know, all those good below the line type jobs in writer's rooms. And I was working at Stephen Boschko Productions. And Stephen had NYPD Blue on him at that time and Murder One, and was just kind of crushing the drama game. But, you know, I always had this comedy side to me. I had a weird sense of humor. Mm-hmm. Didn't know what exactly I was going to do with that until I lost one of the shows I was working on for Stephen got canceled. And I was out of work for probably 6 months. 7 months, and you know, things were looking dire, and I was thinking, okay, this TV career is not going to work out. It's time to, you know, pivot and figure something else out. And then 20th Century Fox, and they say, hey, we have your resume here, and do you know who Matt Groening is? Because he's got a new show coming. And of course, you know, I'm like, yeah, I know who Matt Groening is. So they tell me a little bit about Futurama, and this is right. Only the pilot script had been written. Nothing else really had been done. I mean, Matt and David had, you know, they had conceived all the characters and all that good stuff, and Fox had bought the show, but nobody knew anything about it. And, you know, this is also 1998 when, you know, there's really no internet, and, you know, it's not like it was just Matt's next show. And, but that was a big deal. I mean, you know, Matt had not done anything since, you know, this was the second thing after The Simpsons. So to have the opportunity to go in for this writer's assistant's job on the show was massive. They brought me in, I did the interview, and I got the job. And I was the first writer's assistant on the show, and was with the show the first 2.5 seasons into season 3. And that's really when becoming both a TV writer and an animation writer really kind of took hold of me. You know, being in that writer's room, seeing, you know, how those guys worked, how funny they were, how dedicated they were, how, you know, just watching the process and actually, you know, being a part of a room where you felt, you know, you felt like you were one of the gang, even though you weren't quite yet. You know, there was still work to do to like rise up the ranks and all that. But, you know, David and Matt and all those guys, you know, Ken Keeler and Pat Verone, they always made me feel like I was, you know, one of them and never like just the guy in the corner typing words. So, you know, luckily, by the end of season 2, David, you know, I was pretty vocal about wanting to be a writer, you know, the whole squeaky wheel gets the grease thing. And, David gave me my first opportunity, and I got to write the Anthology of Interest season finale with him and Ken, you know, which was just amazing. Like, I remember getting that phone call in my little apartment up in Westwood, and, you know, just like, you know, you just think that's it. You know, it's like winning the lottery. So it was just really a magical moment in life. And then from there, you know, that's really when I decided that I wanted to be a comedy animation writer. And I took some time away from the show, like I said, about mid-season 3, because my wife, who's Australian, was moving here to LA from Australia. And, you know, we'd had a long distance relationship, but her coming here, you know, I really wanted to spend a lot of quality time with her when she got here. And, you know, the grind on Futurama was still, you know, still pretty legit, you know, even though we had 2 writer's assistants and a big room and all that, the show was still taking a lot of time and, you know, day-to-day time, that is. So I stepped away so I could spend time with her. And we, you know, luckily we ended up getting married shortly thereafter. We just celebrated our 20th wedding anniversary. So that's
great. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's been working out. in the meantime, while I'm, you know, hanging out with my soon to be wife and, you know, we're getting to really solidifying our relationship and all that good stuff. I had also dabbled, in writing comic books, Bill Morrison at Bongo Comics, which was Matt's comic book company, as you guys well know, they asked me to write a couple Simpsons scripts, and that went great. You know, I wrote my first story for Simpsons Comics was the Sideshow Bob story, which, you know, again, I love nice. Sideshow Bob, so it was just like perfect, like the perfect character to like, you know, dive in on that side of things. And then, you know, I the comic book work really kind of kept me afloat and kept me immersed in the Futurama and Simpsons world. You know, I wrote the first issue of Futurama comics and wrote probably between the Futurama comics and Simpsons comics like 30 or 40 published issues over the years. So yeah, you know, it's like really it was. I was in the animation universe at that point, and really like just there was no looking back. I really love writing in animation, and I love the fact that, you know, we, as time has gone on, especially in kids animation, we're getting the opportunity to tell more sophisticated stories.
And do
more comedy. You know, we're really like, you know, there's a whole generation of us that you know, kind of were brought up on The Simpsons and Futurama and Family Guy and all that good stuff. And, And, you know, those people are the ones who are doing, you know, all of these animated shows now. And really just, that's why I think you see the quality of really across the board from preschool to adult. Like, you know, there's so much good, high quality animation out there right now. Not just the look of the show, but there's just the overall quality from writing to voice acting to everything. So it's an awesome time to be an animation writer, to be an animation. And you know, strangely enough, you know, we're in this pandemic, and animation is the one side of the industry that, you know, hasn't skipped a beat. You know, I'd even say it's gotten stronger because, you know, it's the one thing people in our industry know we can produce moving forward and know we can do without, you know, fear of COVID related shutdowns and that sort of thing, you know, because most of us do our thing from our desks in our house anyway. So, you know, we're all just, social distancing, here at our computers and making, making animated shows. So that's my long-winded way of answering that question.
That was great. I mean, you're right. Everything has gotten worse except for cartoons.
Yeah, it's the safe way. Now every voice actor has their mic at home, so they can...
Right.
So I was curious, you know, in that early days, you know, saying you got hired in 98 and the show premiered in 99, like... What was it like working on the show back before the big premiere? You know, from what we've seen, it seemed, you know, very exciting, but also stressful. And I recall on one DVD commentary, David Cohen even said he like briefly quit the show from feeling so overworked. Like, what was it like?
Yeah,
then?
That was legitimately a grind at the start of season one. You know, there was a stretch over that summer where we worked 36 days in a row without a break. And I was the only writer's assistant at that point. So, you know, you're talking, you know, 14 hour days, you know, with everybody, you know, just doing our best to, you know, get this show moving. And, you know, it was a hell of a thing because, you know, it was the second show with Matt's name on it. And that was serious pressure, you know, and there was a lot of tug of war with Fox, you know, over what the show is and what it could be. And, you know, I think they wanted Simpsons 2.0.
Yeah.
And they weren't going to get that. You know, of course it was going to have the Simpsons DNA, but this was David's, you know, this was David's baby. And Matt's baby too, but you know, David really, like, you know, as far as the writing side of it goes, you know, this is, you know, David really wanted to make this its own thing, and he did, of course. But I think that pressure, you know, because David had not run a show by himself before, and you know, he had been one of the higher ups on The Simpsons, but you know, they had 20 people in that room, you know, and there was a hell of a support system and an infrastructure there. You know, we were just, you know, this Futurama was just getting its legs. So I think David, he quit for a minute because he just didn't feel like he could. I'm not speaking for him, but I feel like he just, what I got from him is that he just didn't feel like he could handle the pressure that was being put on him and the show. And, you know, he walked away for a second and, you know, it's just a couple days. If my memory serves correct, it was just a couple days where we didn't have David around. That got worked out pretty quickly. I think Matt worked his magic and, you know, made David feel comfortable about, you know, the fact that he had David's back. And Matt was always good with fighting the fight against Fox. Like, I think that was probably the most important factor in the show continuing and David continuing to be the head of the dragon, I guess, for lack of a better word. Is, you know, I think he needed Matt to go, I'm going to shield you from the crazy pressure that Fox is going to put on us. You don't worry about that. You go make the show that we wanted to make. I will be there to sign off on everything and to tell Fox that this is what we're doing and they can go fly a kite if they don't like it. You know, and I think part of the problem too is, and I think my memory serves correct here, but I think that the executive at the top of Fox Television who bought the show moved on during that whole summer, during that process of us going into production. So there was a new head of Fox who did not like, from what I gathered, did not like the show, did not like sci-fi. Who knows what he thought of Matt? I don't know. He probably didn't like Matt because Matt just did not back down from a fight. And thank God, because Matt was our savior. You know, Matt was the one who, and rightfully so, he could go to Fox and go, "Hey, man, I helped you build this house. You're not going to tell me how to make my second show." You know, and that was really important. You know, like to have that guy go, "You know what? You bought this show. I'm going to give you the show that you bought." You know, and you know, so once we had David back and Matt was, you know, taking care of the business side of it and, you know, keeping Fox away, like, you know, we were off and running. And I'd say by the fall, like the holidays of that year, we were a smooth running ship. And we were just, you know, a normal, regular animated sitcom doing its thing. And it was, but you know, I know all that sounds dramatic, but it really wasn't.
Well, I know from the research we did,
like, you know, it had a little, yeah. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say, yeah, from our little bit of research, we definitely noted that there was a change in executives at Fox in like 98 that we were sure, like, we saw, like, the, like, Bob, right, the Fox time slot changed so much for Futurama for a season.
Yeah, and I wanted to get into that too, because I think most people remember watching Futurama like every day on like Adult Swim or Comedy Central or now Sci-Fi, just like, oh yeah, Futurama is like a faucet I turn on in my house and it just keeps flowing. But we've been going over like how Fox was airing the show 20 years ago, and it was like, okay, you get one 8:30 slot on Sunday, and then we're going to usher you away to Tuesday for a fashion, and then maybe bring you back to Sunday. It just, the time slots kept changing, the days kept changing. What did it feel like on the inside? Because friends of our show, Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein, their series Mission Hill was basically shelved after two episodes. Were you concerned that Fox could just hold on to these production episodes and just never air them, or just burn them off in a summer?
Yeah, that was absolutely a concern. You know, I mean, when we premiered, we were in that 8:30 slot, and I think we only got, I think we got two weeks in a row, and then we were off for like 2 or 3 weeks, and then we came back on for like two more episodes, and then we were off again for two. Like there was no consistency, and you know, our numbers were really good. I mean, particularly in this day and age, like, you know, it's always fun to, like, you know, look at like what Gone with the Wind would make in 2020, right? You know, and go, oh my God, it would have made $6 billion, right? It's kind of fun to look back at what TV shows ratings were, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s before we had, you know, streaming and DVRs and all that good stuff, because, you know, we had damn good numbers in that 8:30 slot, you know, and that was the confounding thing. We were like, look, we lost a little of the Simpsons lead in, but like, we certainly weren't like, you know, the Grand Canyon. It wasn't like, you know, we were losing half their audience. You know, the audience was sticking around to watch the show. And, you know, like with any new show, you know, you got to get the time to come back to it at the normal time slot you say it's going to be on. So when Fox starts jerking it around, and you know, we get two episodes here, and then we're off for 3 weeks, and then, oh, and by the way, now you're on at 7:30, and then, oh yeah, this season you're definitely going to be on at 7 o'clock on Sundays, and oh, by the way, we have football, so, you know, most of the time in the fall, you're not even going to get to air your full episode because we're going to have football spill over into the 7 o'clock hour. Like, you know, it didn't seem like Fox was shy about trying to kill us. But, you know, like the show, just the quality, like just like we rose to the occasion, and, you know, we started winning some awards, and the critics loved the show. And so, you know, it was hard for Fox to justify, truly just canceling us outright and you know, not airing these great episodes, because, you know, we were a little bit of a hit as far as, you know, the critics went and, you know, awards and good stuff like that. So, this is not a punch down to Family Guy, but we had that over Family Guy. You know, Family Guy wasn't winning Writers Guild Awards, and they weren't winning, you know, Best Animated Series Emmys. It was the little show that could, and thank God we got our second life on Comedy Central as well, because that was great. That was such a good time.
I mean, even four seasons under that scenario is just impressive that you guys. I think it really speaks to the great work you were all doing there. I was also curious, you know. From the beginning, you can see these really cool Easter eggs for like Leela's parents or Nibbler, Shadow in the first episode. Like, what, from your vantage point, how early were some of those secrets like baked into the show? Like, were you guys talking about that kind of mythology early on?
Yeah. I mean, I think that was one of the things David and Ken and Matt loved about the opportunity to do this with this show is that they could, have, especially with animation too, you could have the foresight of knowing, okay, you know, we have 8 to 10 months per episode to produce each episode, right? Like from conception of story to finished product. Right. Mm. So in that regard, even if you haven't thought of the Easter egg yet, let's say you wrote a script, but you're not going to see the animatic for it for, you know, let's say 2.5 months, and you're not going to see full animation for, you know, 5 months. You can, if it occurs to you that we can plant something into an episode, you have the time to do it. Because animation takes so long. So, you know, but that being said, like, you know, David and Matt and you know, the guys, they wanted to do these things early on, especially, you know, you brought up the Nibbler and Leela's parents of it all. Like those two things specifically were long cons, you know, they wanted to play, and they paid off well. And, you know, that Nibbler thing, you know, with Fry, falling back into the tube, and, you know, the shadow and all that. I mean, like that was there from the beginning. So, you know, it was really super cool that, you know, they wanted to do that. We're able to pull it off. And, you know, I think it really provided a blueprint for, you know, other shows being able to pull off stuff like that too, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm. So I want to rewind a bit, and a question that we probably should have asked a bit earlier, yeah. But can you clarify, just because we're on the outside of the industry, just what does it mean to be a writer's assistant? What was your role on the show, your duties?
Oh,
and
sure.
Such?
Yeah. Yeah. So a typical writer's assistant is, you are in the room with the writers all day as they are conceiving of episodes, writing episodes, all that good stuff. You are the guy or the gal in the corner who is making sure that all the good ideas get down on paper. And so let's say it's you know, they're pitching out an episode. That is a bit of a grinder sort of day or two, because, you know, the writers are trying to figure out what the story is going to be. And so everything's on the table. And, you know, if they're throwing stuff out and laughing at it, you're writing it down, right? Mm-hmm. And then from there, you know, you start, the writers start to whittle down and hone into, you know, okay, this idea works. And then once they like kind of latch on to what an episode can be, then, you know, then really what's next is basically the story break. That's a day or two of just, you know, going over what the show can be beat by beat, maybe throw in a few jokes. And as a writer's assistant, you're just writing all that down. From there, you will hand off whatever you have, you know, via email or, you know, hard copy to the writer, who will go off and then, you know, write an outline. The writer will be gone for, you know, let's say a handful of days. When they bring that outline back in, that's gone over in the room, but with the entire staff to make that as tight and awesome as possible. You are, you know, the writer's assistant is there, you know, putting those revisions in for the team. Then that's sent away, gets the network and studio approval, then the writer's off to write their script. And then when they bring that script back in, again, the room goes over the script, you know, beat by beat, line by line, joke by joke. And the writer's assistant is the one who, again, is at the computer, writing, you know, making all those revisions and typing that stuff in. And one important thing I've left out is most writer's rooms have a giant TV screen against a wall, and that TV is connected to the writer's assistant's laptop or computer. And so they can see everything that you're getting down. So you're not missing anything, and everything looks good. And you know, that as you probably would expect, all of that is shepherded by the showrunner and, you know, the leader for all that. So, so yeah, that's basically the job. It, you know, it's a lot of, you gotta be a fast typer. You gotta be a good listener. You got to know when to keep your mouth shut and when it's time to, you know, you usually with most good showrunners, you'll develop a rapport and they'll let you know when it's okay to pitch a joke or, you know, they'll ask you your opinion on a story, you know, and I think that's a real key to being good at that job is to not get greedy and want to be, you know, at the grown-ups table too soon. You know, you have to, you know, you got to kind of wait your turn and develop a rapport with the team before, you start to insert yourself, as a writer. So, you know, it's a bit of a, you got to be patient. You got to be patient and you got to wait your turn. But, you know, if you can do that and you're a decent writer, usually you'll get your shot. So, yeah.
So it's been 20 years now. If you were to see one of these old episodes on a rerun or whatever, would you remember, like, oh, I remember this joke really brought the house down, or one writer really fought for this joke. I remember what, like, Diet Coke I was drinking when this was pitched. Do you have, like, specific memories of, like, the jokes that were being thrown around, or is it just kind of a storm in your brain?
Yeah, no. It's a little bit of a storm drain. But, you know, like, there are moments that really do stand out, you know. You know, so, and this is going to sound so egotistical, but like most of the stuff I remember is like specific to like a joke I pitched or something.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So, you know, like some of my favorite moments are, you know, in the 2D Blacktop episode, you know, which is our Fast and Furious show. You know, we were trying to figure out the end of that episode, and you know, I came up with this joke where you know, the gal who is the spaceship racer, she's got this running joke throughout the episode about having issues with her dad, who she can't speak with, and they don't have a relationship and they can't talk. So I pitched this joke about how he didn't hurt her with what he said. It was the words he never said, and you know, just kind of a little dumb joke, like a laughter, tears, like he couldn't catch his breath, and that made like me as a young buck writer, I was like so happy because I was like, oh my god, I made the showrunner cry tears of joy. This is amazing. So you know, just stuff like that. You know, there was John DiMaggio's. You know, he's got these moments at table reads where, you know, he and Billy were so exceptional at like finding weird moments with the way they would, you know, deliver lines. And I forget which episode this was. I think it was the one where Bender and Amy hooked up early in season 7, 6, whatever it was.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a moment in that show where Amy goes to bail Bender out of jail. And Bender pulls out an accordion and he goes, the joke is something along the lines of, that's so sad, Amy. I wrote a little song to cheer you up. Let's go already. And the way John delivered that, like that, we didn't know how he was going to sing that at the table read. But when when he busts that out, he was just, you know, he did that at the end of another episode I wrote, the one where Fry and Leela are in the zoo. That like the end line where he goes, you were in a zoo. Like the way he did that at the table read was just just phenomenal.
Now, just from doing this, hearing it, just the sounds John DiMaggio makes just makes us laugh.
Yeah.
Like he just...
you know, it's so funny because, you know, I've gone on to do a couple other shows as a showrunner, and you know, you wouldn't believe how hard it was for me to like convince the people on at Activision to bring John on for Skylanders Academy. Like, I thought, I was like, this is a home run. I'm gonna get John on this show. This is gonna be great. And they turned me down. They made us go cast a film actor instead of John. And I felt so terrible about that because I'm like, this guy is money in the bank. Like, he's so good. And I can't believe that I have to even ask you if I can put him on the show, let alone you tell me I can't have him on the show because he's not a big enough name. It was so, that was infuriating.
That's
another story.
You know, I did want to ask real quick about the Anthology of Interest 1, because that was one we just covered for our new season. And so not only like how you were approached for it, which that must have been, you know, kind of daunting as a relatively new writer, and you have all these like Harvard graduate Simpsons legends to work with, but also like was the feeling internally always that Anthology of Interest was going to be kind of like Futurama's Treehouse of Horror?
Totally, yeah, it was totally going to be that. You know, it would have been awesome if we had been able to do one of those each season. But you know, I kind of love the fact that, like, you know, we evolved it a little bit with like Saturday Morning Fun Pit and Naturama in the later seasons. You know, Naturama, like that was a blast to write for, you know, because I actually learned stuff in my research on that one. But yeah, like, you know, that first Anthology of Interest, you know, like it, you know, the guys, you know, the group just was really excited about, you know, trying to do like a, you know, sort of a Strange Tales type sci-fi, you know, thing with our universe. And you know, the possibilities would have been endless for sure. You know, it's funny you brought up, you know, being daunted by, you know, writing in the room with those guys. You know, I never felt daunted because, like, I just was so excited to do it, you know. And it's funny to look back, you know, every now and then I'll look back on some older scripts and just look at, like, you know, what mistakes I made, you know, not knowing what I know now and not, you know, compared to then. And, you know, I look back on my first draft and I just go, ah, God, you know, you didn't know anything, Rogers. But, you know, thank God you were there to, like, learn some stuff from these guys because, you know, you suck. but, you know, it being able to write with David and Ken on that episode, you know, it just, like, that was a dream come true. And those two specifically, like, you know, they're idols of mine. Like, they've always taken care of me as far as, you know, teaching me stuff, and whether they knew it or not, you know, they were mentors. And you know, like, and you know, Ken Keeler is one of the great geniuses of TV writing. And you know, I wish we got to see Ken do his thing more, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we totally agree.
He got out of his rat race. He's living in North Carolina or something now. So.
Oh, that sounds nice. Yeah, Ken and David Cohen are not on Twitter, or else we would be bothering them.
Oh, yeah.
They're smart to stay away.
But I really
That's
wanted
right.
to... So about Anthology of Interest, how different was the aired version compared to your final script? Because we know that... it's a very collaborative process. Just because your name is on it doesn't mean you're responsible for every, like, spoken line of dialogue and every frame of animation we see.
You know, you're talking about David and Ken here, whose first drafts or just, you know, every time out, stellar. But it wasn't, you know, my memory of it wasn't that it was too different. You know, definitely that's the one great thing about a good writer's room is, like, you know, you don't send your writer out to write a script without a super solid outline. And I remember, you know, with Futurama, we always had really strong outlines. So, you know, the story structure was always, you know, pretty much the story structure was what it was when I left the room to go write the script to what it aired, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think the biggest thing that changed was, you know, the jokes, you know. You know, the whole, I don't think I had the I might have had the lobster bisque line in my first draft. But, you know, Bender's whole Hamlet Hamlet-esque, you know, death at the end. I think that was conceived in the room when we were rewriting it, or when they were revising it for the table read. Incorporating the Iron Man song, I think that was brought in when we had it in the room. The bop part of it was conceived in the room. So it's mostly just like adding those things and punching up the jokes, really. Like, but story wise, like it was pretty much what we came up with before I went out to write the script.
Cool. I did recall hearing on the commentary, they said like that was just, they wrote, you guys all had too much, like you just had to clip things out of it just to fit it in to the
My first draft, I did over this pandemic, I did a couple, you know, waves of cleaning out my garage, right? And I had a ton of old scripts out there, and I found my first draft.
Oh.
And my dumbass turned in a 25 page act for and I'm telling you guys, 15 pages is tight for one act of a show. I turned in 25. So the biggest mistake there was, hey dummy, you can't just give the writers 25 pages because they only have to cut 10. One of these days I'll have to go back and find that script and look at all the crap I must have overloaded it with, and just to see what they had to cut out. But it was also, that's one of the things you learn as a whippersnapper writer too. You're just like, learning how to edit is so important. It's the biggest mistake I think a young writer can make. It's just, you know, going, hey, well, you said to write all the story, I gave you all the story. And, as a showrunner, you sometimes just, you want a writer to go, hey, why don't you come back to me and we'll have a conversation real quick. If you're going to give me a 25 page script or a script that's like 30% over what it's supposed to be, let's talk about that before you give it to me, because you're going to give me more work than I need. So,
So let's move ahead real briefly to the Comedy Central episodes before we wrap this up. We definitely want to talk to you more about those once we cover those in detail.
Yeah.
But we've just finished covering the second season in complete up close detail, listening to every commentary, reading every source on them. So, but we do want to like just ask briefly about the Comedy Central stuff. How did that happen for you? And what was working for Comedy Central like compared to working under Fox?
It was awesome. I was kind of floating between jobs, and I'd done some freelance animation writing, but this is like 2009 at this point, but to pay my bills, I went back to be a script coordinator on dramas, and I was completely unhappy with that. Like, just, you know, I was like, this is not where I'm meant to be. Mm-hmm. And, I think it was a internet or somebody texted me, they basically put the ear, got the word to me that Futurama was coming back, and it was going to get this two season pickup on Comedy Central. So I immediately emailed David and I said, "Dave, I will do whatever it takes to be part of this show again. Like, you know, you can make me, you know, I'll clean the gutters, man. You tell me the job to do, I'll do it." And, you know, I wanted to be a writer, you know, first and foremost on the staff. But David, you know, he was very honest. He said, "Look, I've got the staff in place already, but I would love to have you back as a writer's assistant. And if you come back, episode to write." And so I was like, "Yes, please. Thank you. I'm there." So, we started back in June of 2009. And it was so much fun. It was like, because it was just like getting on a bike, and you know, you don't forget how to ride the bike, you know. And but this time around, you know, we knew we had a network and a studio that had our backs the entire time. You know, we didn't have to worry about time slot changes. We didn't have to worry about not being promoted. We didn't have to worry about, you know, just feeling the love from Comedy Central. Like they basically were like, we're bringing you back because we love you guys, and we know you can deliver an audience. And so writing the show then was just way more fun, because there was no fear of the corporate overlords, pulling the rug out from under us,
Yeah.
So it's, having those 52 episodes, knowing that those were locked in and we had those 52 episodes to play with. Like, it was really, really a good time. And, I'm a huge fan of shows knowing when they're going to end, and a studio and a network, working with that show and going, hey, look, this has been a good ride. But here's where we are going. This is going to be the end, and we're not going to pick you up after that. So if you want to write towards that end, the ending you've always wanted with the show, do it. And I think David was really excited by that prospect, because, that final episode we did, Meanwhile, I think is the name of the title of the episode. Yeah. It just was such a perfect ending for a show that seemed to keep getting this, keep getting a new life. But like, we knew at that point, like, this should be it, So it really was just like the perfect sci-fi, funny, sweet, capper to, that entire adventure. And, people ask me all the time, they're like, all these shows getting reboots and being brought back, but what about Futurama? And I'm like, look, I don't know this for a fact, but my guess is David feels good about the way it ended, and he probably doesn't want to mess with that. That's my take. I don't know that for a fact. Like, I've never had that conversation with David, but if I were a betting man, I bet somebody, more than one somebody's have gone to him and Matt and said, hey, what do you guys think about doing the show again? And I believe David's probably just like, no, not interested. we ended how we wanted to end, So, who knows, man? Maybe we will be back one day.
I couldn't imagine it. I couldn't imagine coming back without David. Like, he's, Simpsons has had so many different showrunners, but it was always, David Cohen, showrunning Futurama, right?
Right. Yeah.
Well, man, I have a million more questions I like to ask. I did want to just specifically say, though, thank you. You were a real help in one of our earliest podcasts we did, because we didn't know. We were like, okay, Icy Wiener mean the descriptor icy, or does it mean I-S-E-E Wiener? And you on Twitter cleared that up for us.
Oh, good. So thank you. I'm glad I was able to help.
That was one unsolved mystery cleared up for us.
Yes, yeah.
But did you want to plug anything while you're with us, Eric? Like your Twitter account, anything that you're allowed to talk about that you're working on right now?
If anybody wants to come follow me and my nonsense and my crazy tweets, I'm what am I these days? Is it Eric Rogers Here? I think it's at Eric Rogers Here, H-E-R-E, Eric Rogers Here on Twitter. Let's double check that while I'm sitting here with you guys. At Eric Rogers Here, there it is. I do have here's what I'm going to say. I have a brand new series that's locked and loaded that has 52 episodes. I'm showrunner for, head writer. It's sci-fi, it's comedy, it's action. If you guys go to Twitter and you look at my profile, you will see that I have done some playful wording there to tell the world what it is. Because I'm dying to tell the world what it is, but if I say the actual word out loud, the corporate overlords will take my son away. So, but if you go to Twitter and look at my profile, it's right there in the description.
I'm seeing it now. That's extremely clever.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not that clever.
Oh, it's great. I love it.
But that I do not know when that series is going to be announced, but it is sci-fi comedy action half hour, and it's amazing. And it's been the second best work experience of my life it's been the best one since Futurama. Honestly, it's been amazing.
That's awesome.
And I've got next year. I've been writing some preschool for a show called Smash, which will be on HBO Max. It's a kids show about little superheroes at summer camp, and been writing for Polly Pocket as well. Those episodes will be out next year as well. So staying busy, trying to get my own nonsense going as well. So hopefully I have some Eric Rogers madness to put it out into the world sooner than later. But there you go, guys.
Awesome.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us, and we definitely want to have you back again once we get to the later seasons, for sure.
We have just scratched the surface.
That sounds great, guys. I'm totally down for it. You let me know. I'm here.
Help your small business thrive and stay connected with the Comcast Business Complete Connectivity Solution. It's the largest, fastest, reliable network. Advanced gig speed Wi-Fi and cyber threat protection. Get started for just $40 a month for 12 months with no annual contract when you add mobile. Plus, ask how to get up to a $750 prepaid card. Comcast Business, powering possibilities.
Ends 2/21/2023. Restrictions apply. Requires EcoBill and AutoPay. New 100 megabits per second internet and Comcast Business Security Edge customers only. Equipment taxes and fees extra. After 12 months, regular rates apply. Gig internet required for gig Wi-Fi.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.